A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we are feeling the penalty pain as Champions League holders Manchester City are beaten in a shootout by Real Madrid. We'll also discuss Arsenal's second defeat in 4 days against Bayern Munich and wonder what it all means for the title race. And if that's not enough, there'll be loads more to discuss as we look forward to the FA Cup semi-finals and the rest of the weekend's action too. And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we have the Chief Correspondent for The Times and Sunday Times, Martin Samuel, the Football Correspondent for The Sunday Times, Johnny Northcroft, and a former footballer who can definitely handle being put on the spot, especially in the Johnston's Paint Trophy in December 2012, when he scored the fifth penalty to help his crew side beat Doncaster in a competition they went on to win. Gregor Robertson is here to tell us where Bernardo Silva went wrong.
Real pressure,
oh, mate, I'm impressed with that. The anchor penalty. Yeah,
well, as we learned earlier in the season, with that fact about your playing in the school's days, you always wanted fifth pen, didn't you?
Yeah. Always fifth, yeah.
Which meant
that either got out of it or there was something really riding on it.
That's the Ronaldo philosophy, isn't it?
Yeah. Is it?
He always wanted fifth pen, yeah.
Did he?
Yeah.
Well, we are similar.
Yes,
well,
absolutely.
Also, he often says he modelled his career.
No, there was a Euros. He was criticised, wasn't he? Because he wanted the fifth pen, and it was irrelevant in the end because Portugal went out.
Yeah,
And his egotism was criticised. Not that was your.
I'm an egomaniac as well, Johnny. Let's be honest.
Fascinatingly, as well, for the first time this season, there's footage of one of these moments that I'm talking about.
Oh, really?
This penalty shootout actually exists on YouTube, wow. So I was able to watch it. Good pen. Keeper went the right way. And you still went.
There's a surprise in your voice, Tom.
No, yeah. But I didn't know. It's just, you know, you went away into the top corner. It's always a good sign, I think, if the keeper goes the right way and it still goes in. And you don't go too overboard in the celebrations as well.
It was the Johnston's Paint Trophy.
Yeah, mate, come on, they all count.
He's got a sense of respect.
You went on to win it. Anyway, yeah, from the Johnston's Paint Trophy, back to the Champions League and to the Etihad, where Manchester City were knocked out by Real Madrid. Martin, you were there. You just got the train back from Manchester this morning. The joys of the Avanti West Coast service.
Absolutely.
Getting here just about on time. We'll get onto the subject of your piece and some of the wider ramifications, but just kind of sum up how it felt in the stadium on the night. Frustration, the overwhelming word, or was it bigger than that? Was it dejection and devastation?
It's a funny thing with City, isn't it? Because as successful as they are, there isn't such a great love for the Champions League inside that stadium, even now. And it's very interesting. I was talking to someone.
Do you think that's less
now
that they've won it as well?
Well, I don't know. I was talking to someone the other day, and it sort of comes back almost to the Super League and that whole Real Madrid and Barcelona and because the market research in Spain will tell you that 80% of the fans of Real Madrid and Barcelona as well, I'm presuming, care more for the Champions League than they do for La Liga. That's their priority every season, is to be the champions of Europe. In English football, generally, it's the absolute reverse. 80% of English football fans, when asked, will tell you that they'd rather win the Premier League and that the Premier League is the thing. And you got the feeling last night, you know, I'm sitting right on the edge of the press box, so all the fans sort of come past as they're streaming out. And there wasn't a huge amount of cursing. No one's leaning at the press box, down, we've been, you know, all the usual stuff you might get somewhere like Old Trafford or whatever, where people will forever, you know, if they got beat or in Europe, people always saying, oh, they were diving, they were this, they were that. There wasn't any of that. It was sort of like, you know, we should have won. I thought we were a better, you know, you fellas would say, yeah, I thought we were a better team or whatever. But there was a greater acceptance of it. I think when you don't play badly, and City didn't play badly at all. They, you know, we were saying earlier, they probably, over the two legs, they're probably the better team. But when they've got nothing really to complain about, if you know what I mean. They should have put their chances away. They've got done on a penalty shootout. Real Madrid are a very good team. On a personal level, it could not happen to a nicer fellow than Carlo Ancelotti. He's absolutely top, top man. And that's it, really. You know, I there wasn't a sense of fury about it. You know, there wasn't...
Even with the way that Real played, where you could have, you know, even the sense of, oh, they've parked the bus.
Whatever. I would have thought they're used to that at City by now. You know, there's not too many teams want to go toe-to-toe with them. Arsenal didn't the other week.
Plus, they know that Real Madrid are... That's a good team. They're a transition team. They like, they've got Rodrigo and Vinicius.
Yeah.
Absolute speed demons in the corner. And I thought this game kind of played out much... There were some parallels with the first tie, and that, you know, apart from the volume of goals, and that City's influence and sort of superiority and dominance grew as the game progressed. You know, Real Madrid still offered that counter, but City were the better team. It's like Real Madrid defended brilliantly, and it took so long for any sort of chink in the armour and any mistake from Rudiger to allow them a clear chance to score. Speaks to their sort of the way they're organised and their defensive like solidity. But City, I don't think they can have that much to complain about really. And if you've kind of got any sense,
I do hate sort of moralising about styles of play, and it's a modern thing. The whole parking the bus trope, as if that's not a sort of valid tactic. Mm. And I mean, if you're playing as Manchester City, it's just logical. It makes sense. You know, Pep Guardiola is the best at doing what Pep Guardiola does, so it makes sense to try something different. And it's not like Real Madrid sort of changed their style in order to combat Man City. That's what they do at their best under Ancelotti. And I thought City were brilliant, apart from at the top of the pitch, which we'll go on to speak about, I'm sure. But overall, it was a brilliant performance. They didn't bottle it at all. They controlled the game. They had, you know, incredible overloads on the sides. They did everything in Guardiola's plan, except finish their chances off. But Real Madrid, what a watch they were! I thought the sheer concentration and effort that went into that defensive performance. You had footballers that they were like boxers being knocked to the floor, that you thought they were going to get counted out, and then they got up again and were still fighting 15 rounds later. Like Carvajal, you thought, he's not going to last this game. The goalkeeper, after a couple of corners, you thought, one of these is going to go in. You know, Nacho was shaky early on, ends up scoring crucial penalty in the shootout. Rudiger made a mistake for the goal, ends up... when it goes into extra time, you think, there's no way Real Madrid are going to hold out again, and they do. And at the end of extra time, they're creating chances on those breakaways. I thought it was a brilliant performance by both teams, actually. And that sense that you're talking about, Martin, at the Etihad, I'm not surprised really, because if you're a City fan, you just have to have a sense of fatalism about the Champions League. Things happen to them in that competition.
Tottenham goal. That time.
Real Madrid a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I didn't think City needed the Champions League last year for them to be a great side, and I don't think them going out proves anything to the contrary right now, to be honest.
Interesting. Lots of different little factors to pick up on. One I wanted to talk about as a positive, Martin, first, was the subject of your piece, before we get into some of the negatives about how crap Erling Haaland is. More on More to come.
Never make it.
More to come. But Phil Foden and Jude Bellingham, you thought there was a lesson in last night for Gareth Southgate and England.
Yeah, even before. It was just something that I've been thinking for a little while, because I've gone from being quite conservative about the whole thing to think, you know, come on, let's go for it. Because Cole Palmer's changed my mind.
Mm.
Cole Palmer looks... you can't put him down at the moment. And at first I'm thinking in the squad, and then you're just looking at the man's form and thinking, you've got to find a way of getting that into the team, surely. And then if you're trying to get that in the team, then you've got to get Phil Foden in there, because if Pep Guardiola says he's the best player in the country at the moment, well, that's good enough for me. You've got to get Jude Bellingham in there. We've got the three top scorers in three of the major European leagues, because Harry's top in Germany. Cole Palmer is now joint top in England, and Jude Bellingham's top in Spain. So you've got Bellingham as well. Pardon me. So you're looking at that and you're thinking, but that 4-1-4-1 is a really dangerous formation. I mean, Scolari played it at Chelsea and eventually got undone. Sam used to play it, funnily enough, at Bolton as well. And you're thinking, who plays 4-1-4-1? And you're thinking, well, Pep does, really. You know, it might look a different shape, but he basically plays with just Rodri. Now, last year, Rodri and Gundogan, and I know he has players, sometimes Silva is a bit deeper, and, you know. But Pep plays 4-1-4-1. And you're thinking, oh, I wonder if we could do that. I wonder if we could get every single good player. And I know this guy, I know, you know, everyone goes, that's not how you make a team. And you go, yeah, no, I know it's not how you make a team. But we've tried to make a team for 50 years and won nothing. So why don't we try the one where you just go, right, how many good players can we get on the field? And let's cause them a problem. And I just wonder, I know we've got no time to work on it and all of this, and it is the sort of thing that I can say, because it ain't my team, I'm not going to get the sack, I'm not going to be called a turnip on the back pages. But I just looked at City last night and thought, I wonder if England could play like that. I wonder if we could turn Declan Rice into Rodri and then go 4-1-4-1.
Well, it's a fascinating thought, and I'm sure we'll definitely mention it in all the preview shows we've got to come. And we will also be discussing Cole Palmer in part two. So why don't we give Johnny and Gregor time to think about your madcap plan for playing all these attackers, and we'll come back to it in the second half. Because now it's time for How Crap Is Erling Haaland? The favourite part of the show. It's big. We're going big. Roy Keane was right. He's only League Two standard. I'm joking, of course. But, Johnny, it is a fascinating conundrum, if you like, for Pep Guardiola and Manchester City fans and us neutrals as well, because you're looking at this big Champions League game. Off goes your top striker, who's not had a big involvement in the game. In two legs, we talked about it in the first leg. Pep saying, brilliant, he's decoys, you know, he's taking. It's a very expensive and talented decoy. And then you lose
£600,000 a week decoy, Matt.
You then lose a penalty shootout in which you would assume he would have taken and probably scored, maybe.
Cat onto the pitch instead. Well, that'd be quite cheap. If all you wanted was a decoy, you'd just get one of your coaches, bring it, sneak a cat in, right? And just right in the middle of going, right in you go. Whoa, cat's going mental in those sort of situations, all over the place.
We could get Alison's cat, Victor.
That would be a brilliant decoy, and it would. Wouldn't what's a tin of whiskers? It's not 600,000.
No. Cats have moved on from whiskers.
I mean, I used to have a cat, and I'm sure it won't have gone up that much.
No, they've moved on from whiskers, I'm afraid. There's millennial cats out there. They want much better than whiskers.
Much better than whiskers. You say, well, okay. Even if you go for a gourmet cat, even if you really
a Galactico cat,
like tuna in it and stuff like that, maybe you could, you know. You could get a cat on the pitch.
I mean,
That's all I'm saying. You don't need Erling Haaland if all you want is a decoy.
Yeah, well, there you go, Johnny. Try and unpack that.
Well, I was going to say, Stefan Grivac won the World Cup, didn't he, being a decoy?
Yeah.
I mean, France did it in 98 with a...
Him and that pigeon,
he then went to Newcastle and we realised he wasn't a very good striker.
Yeah. And Rangers, and you couldn't even do it in Scotland. But
is Erling Haaland crap? We're obviously being slightly jokey about Erling Haaland being crap and cats.
No, I'm serious about the cat.
Erling Haaland's... He's not crap. He's brilliant at doing what Erling Haaland does. But I think there's a growing question as to whether that fits with what Pep Guardiola does and what Man City do. And really, since that initial sort of first flush of Haaland at the start of his first season, when he just couldn't be stopped, I think there's been a slow sort of retraction in his output, and there's been a sense of teams getting to grips with what he's doing, and there's been a sense of Pep himself losing a little bit of enthusiasm for having that out-and-out number nine and trying to fit other bits around to incorporate it into a more, you know, Guardiola possession heavy team, which is why we've seen Alvarez playing in a large part of the season in midfield, because he still wants that forward that's dropping into midfield and interchanging with his number 10s and all that sort of stuff. And Haaland doesn't do any of that. Of course he doesn't. I mean, he did hit the bar last night with a brilliant header amid an otherwise anonymous performance, which kind of sums up where he is. But I think the real worry is that in the biggest games, he's not performing now. He's not scoring. He's being stopped. I don't think he's scored in four games against Real Madrid. His output in the Champions League overall is quite meagre this year. His goals since he came back from injury in January in this business end of the season have been, by his standards, quite sparing. I think he's only scored in five Premier League games in 12 or something like that. Quite a few of them have been penalties. And to go off in the game, that was the thing. Pep saying that he asked to be taken off. And if he did, that's worrying. Why? You're Erling Haaland, you're the striker. You can't be tired, you've hardly touched the ball. You don't do a lot of pressing. A bit worried if he actually did want to go off, and if he didn't, and Pep's kind of trying to spare his blushes, that speaks of Pep's acknowledgement there's a problem there, and he wants to kind of hide it from everyone. What's happened to Haaland over the last couple of months has left me wondering what his future is at the club really going forward under Pep. Mm. Because we know Guardiola's history. It's about the design. It's not about individuals. And if you don't fit, and it happened to Aguero in the end, you will get moved on. If Guardiola's still there in a year's time, is Haaland? I don't know.
Interesting. Gregor, what do you make of Johnny's points about Haaland?
Yeah, I kind of thought from the start that he was a strange fit. And it's always been couched in this sort of the fact that as long as he's scoring goals, he's happy. He's said it himself. He said it in interviews. He said, "I'm happy, you know, as long as I'm scoring goals and helping the team, I'm okay with essentially sacrificing the rest of my game because of the team I'm playing in, because of the way the opposition set up against me, because of who the manager is and what the style of play is." I always wondered how sustainable that could possibly be for one of the, you know, most prominent footballers on the planet to essentially... Pep Guardiola was asked this question after the first leg. He said, "That was another kind of quiet night for Haaland." He said, "We scored three goals and Haaland was occupying defenders." So, you know, I know we're joking about throwing a cat on, but he was being serious.
Yeah.
But seriously sitting there and saying he was occupying defenders, that gave that helped other lads score.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Come on, that's not good. That's not sustainable. Mm. If he's scoring goals regularly, it's going to... But there's moments too in the game... I was reading this morning, it took him to the 37th minute before he completed a pass. He had 21 touches in the whole game, and that's not unusual. And like, there were a couple of times, there was one where Gvard, like, people look up and they don't actually play it to him now. Like, there was one in the first half, Guardiola wrapped it into him and he tried to lay it off first time and it was misplaced. Like, obviously he's able to do those things, but there does seem to be a reluctance to even really find them unless it's in the box.
Martin, what do you make of... Sorry, go on,
just
on,
really just quick stat on that. I saw this morning, over the two games of Real Madrid, he lost possession more than he completed passes, and that's the antithesis of a Guardiola player.
Martin?
Absolutely. Yeah, look, it's a funny thing. When Guardiola was offered Ronaldo, when there was that chance of buying Ronaldo, He said to the people at Manchester City, "If you want him, I will try to work out a way to integrate him into my team. But at the moment, I haven't got a way to integrate him into my team. But if you want him, I'll, you know, I can't tell you what it is, but I'll try to find a way." And you do wonder whether there is something of that in Haaland, that he was this big ticket item that was good for them to get, but almost even worse for someone else to get and use against them in a system where he worked much better. And Guardiola sat there and gone, right, okay, I'll find a way of integrating him into my team. Now, man scores 50 goals, and if you admit, you
know, it seems bizarre, really.
I mean, you look at his start of last season, we thought, you know, people were talking about Dixie Dean and things like that. So, you know, that's not long ago. But you do wonder whether, over time, in the end, it's a system and it's a process. You know, Ten Hag talks about a process at Manchester United. There is genuinely a process at Manchester City with the way that Guardiola plays football. And in the end, that is stronger than maybe any plan he's got for how Haaland should work in that process. In the end, his faith and what he works on in training every single week is the process.
I think if you were to ask Antonio Rudiger, yeah, would you rather a physical battle against Erling Haaland or the mind games of trying to know whether to go in with a false nine or like a little striker whose movement is really clever and the sort of fluid movement around you? If you asked him which you'd rather, all day long he would take the battle with Haaland. Mm. So, like, I think against the very best opposition as well, that's even truer. So, you know, if you say that to the Luton Town defenders, I think they'd probably rather just sit deep and let the guys play in front of them. They don't want the physical like battle. But the best defenders, when they know how to close space around them, you know, close space, pull together, be really compact, and they're good enough to nip in if there's just a, you know, slightly off kilter pass, they're strong enough to battle them. We're seeing that it's not easy, but it's possible to completely shackle them.
To flip it on its head, though, if you imagine Haaland in a brilliant transitions team, you're thinking about something completely different. Put him in Liverpool instead of Darwin Nunes, who are creating chaos and then feeding the ball in the box.
Mm. He needs space. He needs space to run into.
Then Rudiger wouldn't fancy playing him because, as you say, Gregory, he'd have space to run into. So he's a brilliant talent, but of a particular sort.
That'd be fascinating to see what happens in the coming weeks. And we'll come on to the idea of the coming weeks in the title race just shortly. One quick thing I want to mention. Any long-term listeners to this podcast will know that for many, many years, I have been campaigning for Edison to take a penalty for Manchester City when it matters. And up he steps and scores so wonderfully, so brilliantly. So I just wanted a tiny little segment for us to mention. Penalties in penalty shootouts that didn't mean anything, but that were absolutely majestic. And I'm going to go first with a nomination for Harry Maguire in the Euros final at Wembley. Up steps old Slabhead. Everyone in the office, I was there going, oh my God, Harry Maguire? Bloody hell, surely not. Top bins, absolutely no doubt about it. And of course, England lost. So it means absolutely nothing. But I'll always remember Harry. I'll always remember. So anyway, any other nominations for penalties in shootouts that didn't matter, but that were wonderful anyway?
Well, just to flip the script a little bit. See, goalkeeper would be one of those positions that if you had, like, fantasy, you know, there's an idea that the penalty shootouts are quite boring because all the wrong people are taking them. And that you should get to nominate the player on the opposition team. You go, right, him. We'll have him to take the penalty
or
whatever.
Put a cat in goal or something.
I swear I thought the cat was good.
That would be good, where you go, right, let's get the keeper to take a penalty. Yeah. But you couldn't do it against Man City because the keeper's Edison and you know he'd take a good penalty. The other alternative is where you just get random individuals. You can pick people out of the crowd or have the chairman's missus or
the manager
take a penalty.
The manager. The physio.
The manager and the physio. It would just be fantastic. Much more fun than a normal penalty shootout.
Absolutely. But any other suggestions for good penalties over the years?
I've got a couple. If we're talking about like irrelevant but brilliant penalties in shootouts, I mean...
Yeah, was the subject. Yeah, to be fair. I did somewhat take it.
Martin went off script, as he said, which is unlike him.
It's fine. I mean, Owen Hargreaves in 2006, if we're talking England shootout woe, his penalty was absolutely nailed that. It was absolutely brilliant. Mm-hmm. Germanic, all he'd learned from Bayern Munich amid the disastrous shootout against Portugal when England went out. But
and another one where he stepped up and everyone went, Owen Hargreaves. Owen Hargreaves. What the hell is he taking a penalty for? Turns out he's class at them.
Brilliant. But the one I remember is Asamoah Gyan in 2010.
Yeah.
In Ghana's sort of tear-stained exit to Uruguay when Suarez handles the ball on the line. It's forgotten, Gyan missed a penalty to win the game late in the match. And he was their star player. He was their talisman. Yeah. And then he takes the first penalty in the shootout and you're going, oh my word, you know, the guy's he's crushed enough already, but the mental strength, he had to take the penalty, and it was a fabulous penalty. And they did lose the shootout, but he took that opportunity then to kind of atone for what he'd done during the game.
Yeah, well, speaking of picking yourself back up and seeing if you can atone for a difficult time, Arsenal knocked out by Bayern Munich. Just very quickly on this game, this is very easy for me to say, but it slightly felt like this was coming for Arsenal, not just because of the weekend. You did wonder after that first leg where you got the sense that perhaps they wanted an advantage from that home leg, that Bayern's experience told here. Do you think that's what it was, Martin?
Probably. I've got to admit.
I just mean in terms of the wider thing.
I'm not going to attempt to analyse a game that I haven't seen. But, and you get the feeling as well that mental fragility that was always going to be tested with Arsenal at this stage in the season, you know, it's not looking good.
Mm.
And I'm quite surprised.
Do you think it's mental fragility? Do we think it's both managers, physical?
Both managers kind of admitted as much, I think, in their post-matches. Like, Tuchel was really complimentary in James Gearbrandt's match report today. He said a lot of, like, you know, I think he was asked, is this an elite team or are they close to being elite teams? Like, they're an elite team already. I thought that in preparation. I think that after playing against them in two games, there's maybe just something. He said our best half of the four halves was the last half.
Yeah.
He said, I think that says something about just that little bit of experience that we have, our players have, that they can only get by being here. And Arteta kind of admitted the same thing. So I think if both managers say it and acknowledge it, we can take it as true.
Coming back to the title race, Johnny, and what it means, both for City and but particularly talking about Arsenal, a difficult result against Aston Villa, which we talked about on Monday and said, you know, the title race isn't gone just because they've lost one game. Then they have this setback as well. Thinking about those ideas of picking themselves back up and that kind of mental tiredness, but also physical tiredness as well, maybe. Is that squad strength there? How do you look at Arsenal's season, at now?
I think squad strength is actually the key. I mean, I know there'll be discussion about their mentality, you know, the traditional Arsenal April wobble, and it's hard to argue against that looking at the bold facts of the games. You know, the concerning thing isn't any of these individual games. It's the sequence. It's the wobble against Bayern in the first leg, where they didn't only draw the game, but they were shocked at not being able to win that game easily. I think they thought they would, and Bayern were much better than they thought. And then to follow up with Villa, and then to follow up with what was, I did see the highlights, seemed a fairly flat and tame exit. But I think we need to see it in the round before talking about mentality, because we don't know what they're going to do from here mentality wise. Obviously it's a question. I think the biggest obvious thing right now is what you said about squad strength. It's a tired looking team. They looked tired last night. Arteta doesn't quite have the options, especially in the forward areas, that Klopp and Guardiola has. Saka's, you know, he's tired. Martinelli's off the boil. Havertz has had his brief sort of burst of goals, but maybe that's he's reverting to the norm a little bit. You know, Jesus looks undercooked. Trossard's not doing anything. These are all good players, but there's been a big reliance on these guys. And then he's never had a proper left back, and that's an issue. That was an issue last night with a goal. So it maybe is coming down to just that a team that's been played and played and played and has been performing at a high level and has just physically gone off the boil at the wrong time. Mentally, we'll see. You know, I'd like to believe that they're different, because I get tired of I'm sure Arsenal fans get even more tired.
Yeah.
I get tired of the whole Collapsio thing, but I think physically is the biggest issue at the moment.
Yeah, and going into that match against Wolves at the weekend then, and the rest of the title race, Martin, obviously you wrote on Monday in your column, the title race is not over, and no, of course, very close. We talked about it on Monday's show with Alisson and Tony Cascarino. But in terms of these two results for City and Arsenal, is there a case for saying it's a good thing for the title race that they're both out of the Champions League?
Well, it's look, there is something to be said for having a match at the weekend as your focus. You know, it certainly helped Leicester. It certainly helped Chelsea. The last time Chelsea won the league, the the time that Leicester won the league, they could finish their work on the Sunday or the Saturday or whatever, and then go, right, we've now got 6 days to prepare for the next match and to focus on the next match. No one is slipping a trip to Real Madrid in the middle of it. No one's slipping 2 hours against Real Madrid into the middle of it. So that, I think, is important. But in all likelihood, unless Liverpool do something miraculous again, it's going to be the same for all three teams, really. And it doesn't matter whether City are in the cup or not, because the cup, you know, after this weekend, you shelve the cup until after the title race is decided. So it could, but Arsenal in particular, the psychological effects, I thought there was a lot to be said for them winning. I was super impressed with them the week before it all went wrong. That is the strange thing. And then it all goes wrong. They draw against Bayern Munich, which wasn't the greatest result, but wasn't the biggest disaster. But then they get slapped by Aston Villa. Now they've got beaten again. The week before that, you're looking at that and thinking, this team looks like the real deal. Because they got three results in very, very different ways.
Yep. Brighton.
Brighton being the last one, which was an excellent result. In the middle of the week, resting players against Luton, excellent result. Just put the game to bed. And the previous weekend, obviously going up to Manchester City with the intent of doing a job, and doing that job. Now, you look at 6 matches to go, and you think, well, the job that he's doing is 6 wins out of 6. You'd like to think, the optimist in me would like to think they've got that in them. Wolves this weekend, which is obviously they've got to win, and then Chelsea, which is difficult. And as a defender, the one thing I really wouldn't want to know is that if I make one little mistake, they're going to go 1-0 up, because that fella doesn't miss penalties.
Johnny, you're nodding along with a slight apprehension at Arsenal's fixture.
No, it's a horrible fit. I mean, to go to Wolves on a Saturday night against Gary O'Neill, is just so clever at unpicking you. That's a banana skin. And then you go into Chelsea, and then you go into Spurs.
Yeah.
It will be a fascinating weekend again in the title race. Just quickly coming back to the Champions League, obviously no English sides left in the semi-finals, but lots of English players. Harry Kane, Jude Bellingham. Let's not forget Eric Dier and Jadon Sancho as well, playing for Borussia Dortmund as well. Yeah. Good little player, him. He should get snapped up by one of the English clubs. Who are we going to be cheering on? Who do we think will win? Who are we going to be cheering on? Is it Real Madrid's? We all cheering on Harry Kane? I'm cheering on Harry Kane. Come on.
I'd love Harry to win it. I really would. I think, and it would kind of silence a few of those who laughed about, you know, about what's happened to Bayern in the Bundesliga. I think that'd be great. I really enjoy watching PSG.
It was a great game the other night, wasn't it?
Talk about a team that's completely flipped round what they were. You know, they've still got Mbappe, but what a game that was! And it's a young team. They're a bit random, aren't they? They're open, but they attack. They've got guys who are just, you know, not the finished article, but real talents. Vitinha, Barcola. There'd be something kind of fitting about them winning it at the very point where they've abandoned the Galactico experiment.
Yeah. Martin, who do you want to win? Who do you want to win? Don't give me all that.
I don't care who wins. Honestly, I really don't. I want the best team to win. I want the best team to win. I want the team that deserves it. The team that doesn't make you think, oh, they've got away with that. You know, that's who I want. I'm sorry.
I have to put up with that cat nonsense, and you can't even give me a proper answer.
There's a team that I support. I want them to win.
They don't win very often. So, you know, I want them to win. The rest of it, I couldn't care less.
Gregor?
Know, I just want the best team.
Who do you want to win, Gregor?
I think like, all the things we were saying about Kane, you could make the same case about, like, about Jadon Sancho as well.
Yeah.
The
yeah.
fact that...
What a great story.
What a remarkable story that would be, yeah.
What a great story.
I mean, you could even throw in Ian Mattson, who scored last night. Like, another player, just because he'll make a lot of money for Chelsea and their accountancy you know, figures, has been offloaded, and that looks like I think he would get in Chelsea's team. So, like, there's interesting stories like that. But again, also, I'm stating the obvious, but just the image of Jude Bellingham holding that trophy aloft at 20... just like would cement his status as the England's I don't know, talisman for a decade to come.
It certainly would. Well, listeners, if you've got an answer to who you would like to win the Champions League, you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk, or maybe you've got good stories about favourite penalties and shootouts that didn't matter. I'd love to hear those as well. Stick with us though for now, because next time we're talking about Chelsea and the FA Cup.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Martin Samuel, Johnny Northcroft and Gregor Robertson. Chelsea fans, an apology from me. On Monday, I said how much I loved you for being in mid-table because you're so reliably, wonderfully bonkers. And I dared to suggest that you might lose 9-0 to Everton on Monday night. How wrong I was. A 6-0 win for Mauricio Pochettino's side. But the one thing I was right about was that the man who is turning in more and more into Alan Partridge, just keeps making it all about him. 6-0 win, lad. Just say how great Cole Palmer is. And instead he comes out talking about that penalty row. So now we're going to talk about that penalty row instead of talking about a 6-0 win for Chelsea.
I mean, I'm sure he was asked about it, Tom.
He was asked about it five times.
There you go.
That was his argument. He was very, 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 very upset at the end that all anyone asked about was the tear up over the penalty.
But there's a clever way of doing it, and there's this way of doing it where he storms out of the press conference and makes it all about him.
Open book.
But, Martin Samuel, you were talking about this in one of your pieces on the website this week about Madueke and Jackson. And
Jackson more than Madueke.
Attempts to take the penalty off Cole Palmer. What were your views?
Well, yeah, I think you know my views. It was something that Dele Alli said actually on the night, you know, in terms of where all these penalty takers when it was the last minute against Manchester United. Now, Madueke does attempt to get the ball that night, but is dissuaded, I would say, somewhat more easily than he was the other night. Where Jackson is in it, I do not know, because Jackson's never taken a penalty in his life. I've gone on the various websites that you can use to check these things, and there is no record of Jackson ever taking a penalty. So why he suddenly feels that he's the guy. And I've got sympathy for Pochettino there, because he was asked about it and the man was clearly furious. His English is not perfect, we all know that with Poch, But the answer he gives to the question about the penalty is making even sort of less sense, because you can tell that really he could say a lot more if he could just let me speak Spanish and I'll tell you exactly what I think. But he's trying to stay controlled. He's trying to stay controlled in a language that's not his own. And I shared his fury. I must admit, looking at it on the night, I was, you know, furious that he didn't take both players off straight away. I just went, right, you two come off. But actually, having slept on it, that's why he's the manager of Chelsea and I'm not, because he didn't react impulsively to it that night, and he didn't actually let his anger show at the time and inflame the situation by going, right, you two come off. But he would have been very justified if he did. And what I do not understand is that people tell me, who follow the club, that is the first time he has actually come out publicly and said that Cole Palmer is the penalty taker in the aftermath of that. Now, I can only presume he must be saying it in the dressing room, because I can't see how you would let a on-field committee decide who takes the penalty. That just doesn't seem as if there is any positive that comes out from that. They've already had the aggravation with Raheem Sterling. Cole Palmer's never missed a penalty in his life. He took four for Man City's under-18 team and scored all of them as well. He's taken nine in matches for Chelsea, scored all of them, and he's taken one in a penalty shootout and scored that.
I've just had a horrible vision about the Euros, but anyway, I won't say.
Do you know who'd never missed a penalty in all of their penalty practices in training?
Jamie Carragher.
2006 yeah. World Cup, Jamie Carragher.
Yeah.
So, but you look at that and just think, how could anyone in the dressing room presume to try to take the ball off a guy that's never missed a penalty? It just doesn't. I find it unfathomable.
I was going to say, you teed you up perfectly.
Where were you?
But very quickly, did you ever take them in the games, seeing as you were the big man who fancied the fifth pen? But you never stuck your hand up in game?
No, there was a possibility of me doing it at Crewe, actually, but usually it's a striker, let's be honest. There was a possibility at Crewe, but it never happened.
What do you make of Martin's points about those player rows?
Yeah, it's just an awful spectacle. Like, I'm in agreement. If they must have known.
They must have known.
He's the penalty taker. So
they must have known.
So possibly they could say, "Hey Cole, like, you've already got a hat trick, mate. Could you maybe give this one to me?" Like that.
Mm.
But you don't grab the ball and like take it away as if you're in the playground.
And Nicholas
and then
Jackson
start
was
pushing and shoving.
Pushing and shoving, and he looked so furious
storming off and didn't celebrate
with him when he scored and all of this.
He had to be pushed to, yeah. So, it was a terrible spectacle. I think that there's a right way of doing it. It's possible, you know, sometimes that does happen. A player does give it up. You know, I've already got a hat trick today.
Mm.
But also, not many when they're kind of as ruthless. No. And
did Fernandes do it with Rashford recently, where United were winning or something, and he let Rashford take the pen, the kind of confidence building thing, which is our kind of captaincy thing? Johnny, let's talk about Cole Palmer. Let's come and bring it back to something positive for Chelsea fans.
He's good.
He's quite good, isn't he?
Yeah.
But is he brilliant? Is he superb? Or is he quite good in a really bonkers team?
Oh, you know what? I mean, he's possibly the coolest guy in the Premier League in terms of how he carries himself on the pitch and unflappable. Is he brilliant? I think almost the point of him is that he isn't brilliant, and yet his output is incredible, and that makes him even more admirable. Because if you look at the bits, you know, his pace isn't unbelievable. Yes, he does have a fantastic touch. Does he have a trick? I mean, not really.
I did before the first. But there he is,
nutmegging Branthwaite.
It's also instinctive.
That's what he has.
He has like instincts in the moments where he can like do something that just creates a yard of space on the edge of the box, whatever.
And then
bang.
Yeah, and what I was getting to was, if you talk to scouts about Cole Palmer, they'll tell you that, you know, he wasn't. When City were offloading him, it wasn't that he was identified as, wow, that's a really bad mistake that City are making. Everyone thinks Cole Palmer's a really good talent, but wouldn't have put him up at the Saka, Foden sort of level. And City were happy to offload him.
They, 40 million
as well. Yeah, they thought Matheus Nunes would do better. And you know, I know there's complicated homegrown players, FFP stuff as well. But ultimately, they let him go. It's a fact that he's so much more than the sum of his parts is what I'm trying to say, I suppose. And that's true of a lot of the best players. It's, they perform. They as Gregor said, they find moments where they just put it all together when it really, really counts. And if we're talking about England and World Cups, I mean, I'm still trying to get my head a little bit around the 4-1-4, and I have to be honest.
I surprised myself when I started thinking about
it's more I'm thinking of what sits behind it. You know, how on earth is a creaking Harry Maguire, sort of slow and defence that doesn't have a left back, going to handle that and pick for? But anyway, the principle of getting a guy like that on the pitch in a tournament is absolutely sound, because if it's about mentality and winning games and moments, you know, that's your man. And what would Chelsea have been without him this season?
Oh, relegated.
Truly terrifying.
The player that Johnny was describing there, in many ways, was Frank Lampard.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And that is exactly what Cole Palmer is at the moment. He has got that Lampard-like instinct, and he did something the other night. One of his goals, it involves him driving straight at the six-yard box, and that's exactly what Frank used to do, which is what set him apart from other midfield players, that he played so high, and that when he made that run, his aim wasn't to stop around the edge of the penalty area and let the shot. His aim was to just carry on straight towards the 6-yard box. So he picked up those scraps. He was the guy that, if suddenly it spun off somewhere, that was Frank's ball. And that's why he scored so many goals. And that's why Manchester United had, you know, Ronaldo had to come through to counter that, because they weren't going to win the league again. They had to find somebody who could score 20-odd goals from midfield, and then they found somebody who could score 40, and then they dominate the league. Cole Palmer's goal tally is a Frank Lampard goal tally.
Mm.
That's what it is. What is it, 19 goals 20 now? Twenty goals this season. It's a Frank Lampard. It's in the ballpark of a Frank Lampard goal.
Could easily win the Golden Boot. Just coming back to your 4-1-4-1. Harry Kane is the one up top. Let's not worry about the five behind. But just to clarify, so is it Saka, Foden, Palmer, and Bellingham?
It is. But it would be a way, potentially. I mean, we're in the realms of extreme theory here, but
we've had cats, absolutely.
And we'd throw a cat on. We'd definitely throw a cat on as well, because that would just mix it right up. But it could be a way that you can play Bellingham and Foden central, and then you've got Saka on the right, which makes perfect sense. But you would be playing Cole Palmer on the left. You'd be playing either Cole Palmer or Phil Foden on the left. Looking at Phil Foden on the left last night, you try to find a way to get him into the middle. Then again, you try to find a way of getting Palmer into the middle. We have got a problem, but in trying to accommodate it all. But at the same time, Guardiola says he's the best young player. This is the guy that's the joint top goal scorer. This is the guy that's the top goal scorer in Spain, and this is Bukayo Saka.
And we've got Ollie Watkins.
And we've got Harry Kane. And you're thinking, well, someone's going to be looking at it. You know, if I was a defender, I'd be looking at that and thinking, we've got our hands full today here, lads.
I don't think I'll ever be not surprised by the extent to which England football fans can debate endlessly about tactics and team formation and personnel. I've been doing this for quite a few years now, and it's still, I'm actually filled with dread to think we're approaching the Euros and we're going to have to really get into this.
What you would say is this: of course, the group stage, which you would hope to qualify from, unless, say, a radical formation like this completely starts at the and we lose every single game because we're totally overrun, and Dex looking at the bench going, what have you done for me? But then there could be some players that are performing better than others, and then when you get to the tougher games later on, you can always switch it around and play another guy beside Declan Rice.
This is what happened with Sven. In the end, Sven wouldn't find room for a defensive midfield player because he wanted to play Beckham, Scholes, Lampard and Gerrard. But actually, as we got deeper into the 2004 European Championships, of those four, Beckham wasn't performing. And so it should have been Beckham that Owen Hargreaves came in for.
Do you remember the Argentina team? I think it was 2006. And they basically played four number 10s and a striker.
Yeah.
And they had, what was it, Mascherano or was it? Oh.
Yeah.
They beat somebody 6-0 and then...
Got beat by Germany.
Yeah, that's right.
But they took all the good players off, right, didn't they? They got into a strong position against Germany and went, right, let's get the celebration ponchos out, lads. And the next thing you knew, they were 3-2 down England, or whatever it was. Yeah.
Johnny, I'm just checking as a Scot. Do you want to be part of the England preview show as well? Greg is missing out.
I will if they're playing, 1-6.
Absolutely. Yeah. Marcus Rashford at right back. You'll hear it here first. Chelsea, of course, got a big weekend, an FA Cup semi-final, and Cole Palmer going up against his old team, Manchester City, in the other big game, Coventry against Manchester United. Quickly finishing with Chelsea, this is obviously a huge game. They keep doing these mad things in the league. Great performance, then draw 2-2 with Sheffield United and it's all chaos again. Have they got any chance of beating City?
Yes.
Why?
Well, because they've just played 2 hours against Real Madrid on a Wednesday night, for starters. that's why. And Chelsea have just won 6-0. And Cole Palmer's on fire. And Chelsea gave Liverpool a game when everyone thought, well, Liverpool are so much better than them. And when do they score? They score 2 hours in, is the first goal of the game. So, yeah, they've got a chance.
Johnny?
But if I was having a bet, I'd bet on Man City, but they've got a chance.
No, I agree. I think City are a dangerous opponent, actually. Chelsea are a dangerous opponent for City. They've shown that this season already. Very good on transitions, unpredictable, bit of chaos. Pep doesn't like chaos. And fresh. Yeah, and Cole Palmer.
And Cole Palmer. Gregor?
Yeah, they've risen to these kind of occasions, actually, more so than against Burnley or whatever. So, so absolutely, yeah.
Coventry, Manchester United then. We're all back in Coventry for this one. Straightforward, isn't it? Where Manchester United have been playing this season. Gregor, they will actually, all jokes aside, Coventry will give Manchester United a really good game, won't they?
What they will be is like really, really well organised. And they'll offer a real threat on the break as well. They've slightly come off the boil in the Championship of late, but...
Maybe with this game in mind, just like thinking we've got Wembley, we've got Man United, we've got...
I don't know if it's with this game in mind, but they've risen to occasions like these many, many times, and even making the kind of the playoffs and the playoff final last year. And I suppose that experience actually will help them, having played at Wembley and played in big games like that. So,
and a manager like Mark Robbins, who's basically seen it all as well with Coventry as well. He's seen some terrible, terrible times and some great times as well.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary story. But the club he inherited, I think, just going down into League Two when he got the job. Taking them to the brink of the Premier League last season. You feel that as long as he's there, they'll continue knocking on the door. And I think this, and the teams have beaten on the way to the semi-final, this kind of underlines his sort of tactical nous as well in one-off games.
Manchester United then, for Eric Ten Hag, much like Mauricio Pochettino, this is a huge game, this is the season really. Is there any kind of performance that he can kind of put in? If they win 5-0 and it's like, oh, brilliant, but it kind of feels like he's at the stage where that's the absolute minimum.
He has to get through this and win the cup, I think. I mean, look, he could keep his job, whatever, because I think there's other factors at play, as in they don't know who would replace him. Do they have the money at this point in time to do that big managerial change? Are they going to wait for Dan Ashworth to get in situ? So, that there's reasons he could survive beyond this season, because it's an odd situation at United at the moment. But in terms of his credibility and his long term prospects, I think he could really do with somehow struggling through this one, and somehow winning the cup.
Martin,
the strange thing is that he could get beat tomorrow and still end up as Manchester United manager next season for all the factors that Johnny says. By the same token, he could beat Coventry, he could
beat Manchester City in the final. He could win the cup. And if Ineos' man comes along, the guy that they think he could be out of a job, in the way that Van Gaal won the cup and was gone within 24 hours,
yeah.
48 hours. I don't see these guys as the sentimental type. I don't see them as people who will be swayed by beating Manchester City in the final, say, if it was another Manchester derby. I don't see them as someone who would be swayed by an emotional occasion like that if the person they wanted, they could get. So in that respect, what they need is a performance, because there haven't been too many this season.
What do we make of that performances of late, Johnny? Greg has talked about it a lot recently, of needing to see from Ten Hag kind of what I'm trying to do here. You know, with some managers, when they're going through bad patches, you can see what he's trying to do. You know, even the great Jurgen Klopp at the very start of his Liverpool career sometimes didn't get performances.
Yeah.
You can see what you're trying to do.
I think from that angle it's getting worse, not better.
Yeah.
That's the problem. I was at the Brentford game, which was unbelievable how they were battered, thrown a lifeline and then chucked it away. Just said so much about how dysfunctional they are, and I think the issue is, what are they right now? They've become a team where the parts don't fit together, where occasionally Bruno Fernandes bails them out, and the young players maybe I don't want to say losing their way, but there's little signs that you're worried about, like Garnacho and the sort of storm this week over his liking the social media post, or even Colby Mainoo, who I'm looking at thinking, like a lot of Man United midfielders in recent years, he looks like he's having to try and do everything. And you're thinking, you're 18 and you're playing in this mess, and you're at a point where you should be learning a role. You should be learning, in a stable environment. And he's having to try and defend, he's trying to have an attack, try to score. So I just think it's like they've reverted, they're slowly reverting to what they were before Ten Hag, and that's worrying.
You don't know what they are.
Of Ten Hag.
Yeah.
You don't know what they are. No. That's the thing. I can remember many years ago Harry Redknapp talking about England, and he said, you don't know what we are anymore. He said, are we kicking it? Are we passing it? Are we, what are we? And he said, and you see players look like world beaters against us. He said, and you're looking at this fellow and thinking, he was at West Brom last season. He couldn't get in the team. He said, and suddenly, he said, because the other team have got a structure and a way of playing and they know what they're about. And so this guy that was a West Brom reserve looks completely at home with what he's doing. He said, and you look at England with all these, great players, and we didn't have any direction. And Gareth Southgate did sort that out. And that's a bit like Manchester United at the moment, where you're looking at thinking, well, what is this?
Definitely get that direction with your 4-1-4-1 anyway with the England team. I'm joking. But very, very, very quickly, coming back to the managerial situation with United. I'm going to regret that one. With the managerial situation, just very quickly, obviously Xabi Alonso winning a wonderful title with Bayer Leverkusen this weekend. We know he's not going anywhere. It is going to be a fascinating summer. We've obviously got the Euros as well, but it feels like there's going to be a huge amount of excitement and drama and debate around managerial situations. Do you think that plays into the Ten Hag factor as well with United and Ineos, where there are a lot of big clubs, bigger clubs in terms of maybe success and potential, who will be looking for managers, and that United are maybe kind of sitting back and going, we don't know who would end up here if we get rid of them?
Yeah, they're no longer at the top of the pecking order for exactly that, Tom. They can't go out and say, right, we're having the best manager that's out there, because the best manager out there may well go to Liverpool instead. That's where United are.
Or Barcelona.
By the same token, Thomas Tuchel could win his second European Cup and be out of a job. Now, if his people phoned Jim Ratcliffe and said, oh, by the way, Tom would be very happy to speak to Manchester United, I'm not sure what Ten Hag could do if they thought Thomas Tuchel was a coach that could bring United on.
Yeah. I think the other factor is, if you look at Dan Ashworth and you look at Brailsford and Ineos, culture and all that's so important to them, and they're methodical sort of builders. And I think that's the other thing, that there's a period of trying to sort out what it looks like and then which manager fits that, which again is something that might just give Ten Hag a stay of execution. I think the other clubs,
or
Liverpool,
part of a job.
Or give, or, well, yeah, maybe, or Gareth Southgate or whatever, yeah. You know, but whereas if you look at Liverpool, they know who they are, you know, to speak to Harry, they know exactly who they are, and they know, therefore it gives them a pretty good idea of what's the logical next step after Klopp. United are still trying to sort out the what's it supposed to look like before they sort out the head coach.
It's in that sort of boomerang cycle where what we need now is the opposite of him.
Yeah,
you know, like where England had that for a number of years. You know, we had there was Sven, and then it was Steve McLaren out of a sense of continuity, and then it was decided that he was too matey with all the players, and you know, he goes, so we go in there with Fabio Capello and hit everyone with sticks and stuff like this. And then, you know, after Fabio, we can't have that again. You know, that's all good. You know, genial Uncle Roy comes in, who's not quite as genial as everyone thinks he is. But, you know, and then, you know, and then there was Sam Allardyce, and you know, it was just this constant sort of, you know, state of flux.
Yeah.
And that's where you think United are at the moment.
A managerial merry-go-round, an attacking England side, and Cats as strikers. You've had it all on this game podcast.
No,
Johnny,
no, not strikers. You wouldn't play them as strikers.
Oh, sorry, of course.
Because they couldn't hold the ball up. You know, they're not natural back to goal. They're decoys.
Fade out, Neil. Fade out.
But they'd pounce on chances, wouldn't they?
Fade
exactly.
out.
Exactly, all pounce on chances. There we go. You see, Johnny's into it. There we go.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.